Hello and welcome to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast in which Lowy Institute researchers and some of the world's leading experts delve into the big issues in international affairs. My name is Alexander Dayant, and I am a research fellow here at the Institute. Today, we're going to challenge the broad concept of development and learn about an innovative and life-affirming alternative coming directly from Bhutan to instead look at prosperity through the measure of happiness. To learn more about this new paradigm of development, I am delighted to be speaking with Dr. Julia Kim, the program director of the Growth National Happiness Center in Bhutan. The center is a national NGO that spreads awareness about GNH in Bhutan and internationally. Julia joined the center in 2013 after serving as a member of the International Expert Working Group for a New Development Paradigm. Prior to living in Bhutan, Julia worked as a physician and HIV researcher in Africa and Asia before serving with the United Nations in New York. It is not every day that we get to discuss the concept of happiness on this podcast. So I want to thank you very much, Julia, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, Alexander. It's a pleasure.
First, I'd like to start by asking a question about you, Julia. Could you tell us a little bit about your personal journey away from the UN, an organization that does so much important development work globally, to become first a senior program advisor and then the program director of the Growth National Happiness Center in Bhutan? I mean, what prompted your interest in understanding the wider concept of happiness?
Well, it's interesting that I was working at the United Nations Development Program in New York, and which is really the center of thinking about global development issues. I was living in New York City in Manhattan, quite a fast-paced life, as many people are aware. And just prior to that, I'd been living in South Africa, and primarily rural South Africa. And there was something about the experience of going to a so-called developing country and really experiencing what it feels like to slow down, to be living more in community, to have more time on your hands, to be surrounded by nature. And at the same time, there was a lot of material poverty. It's not to romanticize that at all. I was working as a doctor and an AIDS researcher. But it did pique a lot of questions in my own mind about what is development? And what are some of the assumptions I and others carry that the so-called developing countries are like small, underdeveloped children who need to grow up and become more like the developed countries, for example, the United States. And that was highlighted the more I started to do international work and realized that in many countries, there seemed to be something that was being lost as people jumped on the material development bandwagon. And it really came to a head when the Prime Minister of Bhutan came to speak at the United Nations in 2012 and really spoke about happiness as a new development paradigm. That kind of really broke it wide open for me. The questions I've been holding in myself for a long time suddenly had space to breathe.
All right. And so did you have an interaction with the Prime Minister, or was your interaction the reason why you moved to Bhutan afterwards?
You know, it was a number of things that were happening at the time. One was it was a time when the Millennium Development Goals were coming to a close, and people were asking, what's next? What's the big global agenda? And I was really feeling that there was something about the questions we were asking that needed to be looked into more deeply. And so when this Prime Minister of Bhutan spoke about happiness and well-being of all life as being the purpose of development, I remember the hair on the back of my neck stood up, because this was not small little sectoral programs on malnutrition and environment and immunizations. It was looking at the big picture. You know, what is the purpose of human life? What are we aspiring to? And to me, that was at the center of our understanding of development. And I really wanted to learn more. It helped that I totally fell in love with Bhutan. It's a country that really spoke to my heart. And after spending a lot of time in Southern Africa, again, being immersed in a culture that where nature is very much alive and hasn't all been paved over, really made me feel like this is a country I needed to understand and dive into more deeply.
Bhutan looks like, sounds like an amazing country. Obviously, you know, like it is. Seems to be difficult to get there at the moment, but this is definitely a place that I want to visit at some point. But yeah, so now in Bhutan, you work on spreading awareness about the Gross National Happiness Index, or GNH. GNH is an alternative to the Gross Domestic Product, or GDP, the predominant global measures for evaluating national progress, which mostly looks at production and consumption. So could you give us a quick overview of the GNH, a quick one-on-one? How does this work and what does it tell us? But actually, before this, could you please tell us what is wrong with the GDP and why do we need another measure? I mean, you know, I am using GDP on a daily basis here at the Institute for my economic analysis. So am I doing something wrong?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think many people don't really think about GDP as a number. It's kind of like the air that we breathe. It's so much a part of our culture. But it's interesting that GNH is a play on those words. Instead of gross national product, it's gross national happiness. So it's asking, what should we be measuring as our priority? In terms of the problems with GDP, I think it was really formulated in the 1940s by Simon Kuznets. And as you think back to that time, we were just coming out of the Great Depression. And it was to help predict fluctuations in economic growth. Makes sense. But he never intended it to be taken as a measure of how a country is doing, whether it's flourishing, what its status in the world should be, in the way that it's taken to be now. And if you were to ask what are the problems with that number being used in that way, you could distill it down to three things: what it measures, what it fails to measure, and what it hides. So what it measures is only marketed economic activity, as you rightly put it before. So that means that anything that is leading to economic activity, for example, there's more crime in your cities, and so you need more prisons and you need more ambulances because people are getting shot. GDP starts to go up. Similarly, if you have a beautiful rainforest and you start cutting down all the trees, GDP goes up. Not in any way showing what are some of the negative consequences of those activities. In terms of what it fails to measure are all the activities that are not actually part of the marketed cost of the economy. And a lot of those really became important to us and very evident during the COVID pandemic. So spending time together, caring for yourself and for family members, if you're looking after small children or looking after elderly parents and not paying somebody else to do that, none of that gets costed or counted in GDP. And finally, and probably one of the most dangerous things about GDP is it's hiding the growing inequality. So the GDP number can keep going up and politicians can still boast about it. And yet the quality of life is deteriorating in a country and there's rising inequality and declining happiness and well-being in countries. So for those reasons, GDP is problematic. So if you look at GNH, gross national happiness, it's really saying, what if we were to measure what really matters and the economy is in the service of well-being and happiness, not well-being and happiness being in service of the economy? So when you do that, you start to ask questions about what makes a thriving, flourishing society. And in Bhutan, they have been measuring this in 9 domains as part of a national survey. And the 9 domains include things that are familiar to many countries: health, education, living standards. I think they're measured in Australia and many countries because they're building blocks for a society to be working well. But what's unique and very interesting about Bhutan's survey is they also look at things like psychological well-being, time use. So many of us speak about being time poor. How much control and freedom do we have with our time? Very much impacts on our sense of well-being. Community vitality, hugely important during the pandemic. Do you feel part of a community? Do you know your neighbors? If something happened to you, do you feel like somebody would have your back? Very important to our sense of well-being. Cultural diversity and resilience, is that welcomed? Is it thriving? Good governance, do we trust our governments? Are we participating in voting? Environmental conservation. All of these different domains are measured as creating an environment where people can be happy.
But I guess some of those domains, as you mentioned, are in some way subjective to a country, right? I mean, the understanding of happiness can differ from person to person or across countries or cultures. And in addition, you know, one's own understanding of happiness can also change over time. So therefore, happiness scores cannot be viably and reliably compared across individual time or countries, can they? I mean, like, is the GNH exportable?
I think that's happiness is an interesting word because it can mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And for many folks, you think about it as the kind of smiley face, being in a good mood. And you're right, that goes up and down. Researchers often call it hedonia. And that's not really what we're talking about when we speak about happiness in GNH. It's actually quite a bit more profound than that. I think the Prime Minister of Bhutan, who brought the idea of GNH to the United Nations, Jigme Tinle, gave this really beautiful definition of happiness, where he said that true abiding happiness, so not this fleeting, unstable happiness, but lasting happiness, can't exist while others suffer, but comes from serving others, living in harmony with nature, and coming to know our innate wisdom and the true and brilliant nature of our own minds. So it's a very relational idea of happiness. It's not my little personal pod of happiness that I protect against everybody else. It's how am I living in relationship to other people, to the natural world, and even to myself, to my own sense of meaning and purpose. And then if that is a definition of happiness, what Bhutan is trying to do is create the societal conditions where happiness can flourish. The government can't make you be happy, and you're absolutely right, there's individual variations in all those. But as a government, they can create the conditions where people can be happy. And that's where those nine domains do come in and are very, very important. I think it is exportable. It's not that the exact same questions in the survey or the exact same domains would have to be measured in every context. But it's more the principle that it's a holistic, multidimensional measure of well-being that doesn't just look at the economic, financial aspects. All this could sound like it's very aspirational and it sounds great, but you know, how do you put that into practice? And I think that's how the survey tool is important, because you can track things over time and you can compare how are men doing compared to women. How are young people doing compared to older people? What about rural folks versus urban people? And when you see the differences as a policymaker, it should make you ask deeper questions and think, how do we respond to that? And that's what the GNH Commission, which is the planning commission in the country, does. And they screen policies using the nine domains that I mentioned earlier. So if you wanted to build a mine, for example, you'd have to show what would be the impacts on those nine domains, not just on the financial impact, and then modify that proposal in order to show how it might be more favorable to GNH. So I think that's, again, it's the whole package. It's the vision, it's the measurement, and then it's translating that into action.
But so you talked about like those nine measures for like the happiness of the population. How do you balance this with the, you know, we live in this capitalist society that needs to make more profit, that needs to make more money. How do you put those two in the balance and take like the best outcome decision for those two key actors?
So again, it's really saying that it's not saying that business and that economic activity is bad per se. It's saying, how does it contribute to and is it in service of well-being and happiness? Or, as is currently the case in many countries, it's actually leading to environmental devastation and growing inequality and actually not contributing to well-being and happiness. So it's really saying, how does the economy fit within planetary boundaries and how does it serve the well-being of people rather than being its own kind of discipline, and then we kind of accommodate around the economy.
How do you explain the success of Bhutan in putting happiness on the global development agenda? I mean, does it come from the fact that Bhutan had deployed the right salespeople, i.e. like policy entrepreneurs, to sell the idea to the world, or were we just collectively exhausted with classical development measures?
You know, I think it's not so much about selling an idea to the world. I think the Bhutanese leadership are actually quite humble about GNH. It's actually, I think, an idea whose time had come. You know, if you think back to 2009, we had the Beyond GDP report by Joseph Stiglitz, who I think was recently on your podcast, Amartya Sen, Jean-Paul Fitoussi, the Commission on the Measurement of Economic Performance, and they were really critiquing GDP as a measure. as I mentioned, we were coming towards the end of the MDGs, and there was a sense of what should we be measuring? What is going to get the planet moving in the right direction? And we were really seeing the convergence of the financial crisis, the climate crisis, and now we have the COVID crisis coming together. So there was a sense that the current economic system has led us down a path that has been very harmful, and that there's a change, there was a wind of change in the air. So I think GNH landed in that context and continues to be reinvigorated by the kinds of conversations that are happening as we're witnessing the fallout of neoliberal economics and many of the policies that have led to the kind of devastation and crisis that we're seeing now.
So the GNH landed at the right time in the right place. And I think, it definitely contributes to, discussions to go beyond like the classic development concept that we have. And I mean, for me, definitely it is it's a great conversation. Even preparing for this podcast, I must say, I've learned quite a lot. And it gives me, the incentive to try to do like development work in a different way. And actually on the GNH, I have another question. It's, I want to understand, how does GNH and Bhutan keep the forces of modernity, such as, like social media, immediacy, and convenience. How do they keep those forces at bay with all their seduction and potential disappointments?
I think that's one of the challenges that Bhutan is currently facing and will continue to face, as many countries do, because of the globalized consumerist culture that we are all exposed to. One of the ministers in Bhutan said, "We can't be a GNH bubble in a GDP world." And that is so true because of internet, social media, and so on. There are organizations in Bhutan that are really aiming to help young people navigate social media and to have the discernment to realize that not everything they see on their screens is as it appears. Most of the images that kids get of the so-called developed countries shows everybody smiling and wealthy and doing really great. And we know that that's not the case. The other thing I think that's important to say is the education system has been for many years now trying to incorporate GNH values and understanding into the education system. And that there is a sense also, I think, not just in Bhutan, but around the world, that there's more and more understanding about the neuroscience of happiness and well-being, and more evidence that our consumerist competitive culture is actually undermining people's sense of well-being. We're not so much a victim of our genes or our circumstances either. And I think what's interesting about GNH is it's both about the system, the economic system, and about a consciousness shift about our states of mind. And we know more and more from neuroscience that our ability to be happy and to be resilient can be cultivated. It can actually be thought of as a skill. And for those who are interested, some really great research coming out from Richard Davidson and the Center for Healthy Minds, showing that at the education level, at schools and so on, we can also really train our capacity to be aware, to be compassionate, to have insight and a sense of purpose in life. And so that's also an aspect of GNH. It's also our state of mind and really being aware of our consciousness.
All right. And so earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that, time use was something important in the GNH. And so how using a different economic measures captures women contribution to society? I mean, does it change the way women, particularly women in developing nations, engage with their communities? Does it more accurately captures unpaid but crucial caring and domestic work that is often carried out by women?
Yes, I think these kinds of measures like GNH should be doing that, because they're capturing what are the end results of a lot of this unpaid caring economy that is largely driven by women. So a lot of the things that we take for granted end up improving things like health, education, community vitality, the cultural life. A lot of that is not marketed economic activity, and a lot of it, as you said, is gendered. I haven't seen so much analysis of that gendered aspect in relation to GNH, and I think it would be really interesting to do that. But you're absolutely right. In theory, it should be very much showing that up much more clearly than our current GDP framework does.
Being in lockdown in Sydney, I do have to ask you questions about COVID-19. My first question is to know how the pandemic has impacted GNH in Bhutan. And on the flip side, how has GNH impacted Bhutan's response to COVID-19? I mean, is GNH the secret behind Bhutan's highly successful vaccination campaign?
Well, I think in response to your first question, you know, one of the main sources of revenue for the country is tourism. So as you can imagine, it's been a big blow to Bhutan to have to shut its borders in that way. I think on the other hand, the country has been very resilient in response to both the economic shocks and to the virus in particular. So if you've been reading the newspaper, Bhutan has showed up usually with a headline, something to the effect of the unlikeliest success story. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fair to say that it's been helped by the fact that it's a small country. Definitely smaller countries are able to respond to this pandemic with a little bit more agility. But on the other hand, there are a lot of other small countries that have not fared so well. And Bhutan on the surface has a lot of it stacked against it. Not so many doctors per capita, very few ventilators and ICUs in the country. Next door to India, where we've seen the devastating impact of COVID. So I do think that GNH has provided kind of resilient response to the COVID virus by building a well-being economy for years beforehand. And you see that show up, for example, in one of the nine domains being good governance. So there is a sense that leadership stepped forward. And whether you're talking about the prime minister, who, as luck would have it, happens to be a doctor, or you're talking about the fifth king, who was very vocal and really encouraging healthcare workers and encouraging folks to get tested and to get vaccinated, even trekking up to high altitudes to small villages. There is a sense of trust and a sense of people pulling together that really helped the country to move forward. I think also interesting that they brought together the best of modern science and traditional wisdom. So, for example, they were able to test and track infections. They were able to vaccinate even in remote areas because they had a whole cadre of volunteers and a culture of volunteering where a lot of the civil society organizations were helping government. They were sewing and making masks to get them out to rural areas. A lot of my colleagues at the office were getting their sewing machines out and making masks. You had farmers donating food to people who had to be in lockdown so they wouldn't have to worry about that. You also had, in a very interesting way of timing when they were going to start the vaccine campaign, they actually consulted the local spiritual leaders and an astrologer to say when is the most auspicious date to begin vaccinating. And unlike other countries that might have started with their oldest, they actually were instructed that a woman born in the year of the monkey, which ended up being 30 years old, should be the first person vaccinated by a healthcare worker also born during that year. And after that, they were able to cover, I think, almost 95% of their eligible adult population within 2 weeks. So quite a remarkable success story. And I think only two deaths since the start of the pandemic. So really remarkable for a small country.
Yeah, and I think the vaccination rate in Bhutan was above the one from Israel that, you know, was recognized as like an international success. Congratulations to Bhutan. And so, you know, like Bhutan is a largely Buddhist country and GNH is described as being based on Buddhist concepts of contentment, calm and compassion. And all around the world, we saw that the COVID-19 pandemic forced us to slow down and to examine how we extend compassion to the most vulnerable in our local, national, and international communities. As you say, you know, like in Bhutan, it seems normal that farmers were giving food to others, helping each other. And now, you know, like as the world collectively emerges from the pandemic, what key lessons stand out for improving societal well-being and you know, like sustainable economies going forward?
You know, I think one of the powerful lessons I've certainly felt it myself is this fact that we are interdependent. As much as we value our independence and individual freedoms, there's nothing like this virus to teach us how interdependent we are. And I think on the one hand, you can see it as something that's scary because it's because of our interdependence that our economies are so intertwined and that our travel and all of that has really needed to be looked at. But it's also some really beautiful examples of how people and communities have come together to help each other have really emerged. I think there's been also some interesting lessons around vaccine nationalism, you know, that we cannot actually defeat a global pandemic if we only look after our own, in quotation marks. You know, we've seen what happened with the Delta variant in countries that had great vaccination rates and were kind of patting themselves on the shoulder are now having to go into lockdown because other countries were not able to contain it and we can't live in our individual bubbles. So a huge wake-up call for that, our interdependence, which also reflects on a lot of other issues like climate change. I think that's one of the really big lessons. I think also reconnecting to what it means to be human, what's important to us, how much is enough, you know, this whole idea of sufficiency and contentment. Personally, there were a lot of things I learned I could quite happily do without during the pandemic, and I'm not eager to pick them up again. Now that we're starting to open up, I think it's an opportunity to think about what do we want the new normal to be rather than rushing back to the old normal, which was quite frankly dysfunctional.
I mean, look, to be honest, like right now in lockdown, I do feel that I appreciate every little pieces of my previous life, especially because I can't have it. But you're right, like there are some aspect of it that I hope will change in the future. And notably this global effort cooperation, and I hope those took a long time to happen during this crisis. But now like it seems that they're kind of, you know, like the ball is rolling. And I hope like going ahead, going forward, things are going to get better and better. But actually, yes, looking ahead, how do you see the use of GNH measure evolving over the next few years?
I think in Bhutan, it's been largely driven by great leadership and the government, a little bit top down, you could say. And as Bhutan is evolving, flexing their muscle as a young democracy, I think we'll start to see the Bhutanese civil society, ordinary people, starting to become more engaged with GNH, not take it so much for granted, and maybe also starting to trickle into business and other areas of life there. Internationally, I think it's a really interesting moment. I think I'm seeing more and more countries and more people being interested in GNH-like economies. Well-being economies are springing up. Well-being Economy Alliance is a great organization that has been trying to connect different countries, including, I think, Iceland, also governments in Wales, Scotland, and most recently in Canada, to start moving in the direction of a well-being economy. So that's starting to take root. I recently became a member of the Club of Rome, which has just launched a new initiative with the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, the Stockholm Resilience Center, and the Norwegian Business School. It's called Earth for All. And in that context, they're setting up a high-level 21st Century Transformational Economics Commission. So again, looking at, instead of just critiquing GDP, what are the examples and what are the real lessons that we can take to move forward? So I see this gathering momentum and becoming something that's less a fringe and more well-known and more mainstream.
To finish, for my colleagues at the Institute and also for our audience and maybe even for the Australian government, could you give us one piece of advice on how to construct and nourish a healthier society?
You know, I'd come back to this definition of happiness in GNH and say it's both levels, the inner shift in consciousness and the outer systems change. So I think whether you're talking about starting with yourself or your family or your community, to really dig down into relationships, local economies, looking after each other, and really cultivating the resilience skills that I talked about earlier, you know, with the wealth of neuroscience research, with the different capacities to cultivate compassion and closeness, meditation, we're living at an extraordinary time where we can actually step into those things. And also keeping an eye on the big picture. This is a moment which I like to think of as the emperor has no clothes, you know, that child story, where we can really look at the GDP-based economy and say, oh my God, this emperor has no clothes and something else needs to be emerging, and to really look for positive narratives, positive examples. In Australia, I know that Sydney is moving into trying out the donut economics model. Economist Kate Raworth has been really instrumental in bringing that to the fore. And that's also a well-being economy model. We have had a number of visitors from Australia come on our GNH Center programs. We've collaborated with a group called small giants in Australia to look at how businesses and organizations and smaller localities, if not, it can't be the whole country, but what are the bite-sized pieces where you can start innovating towards well-being and GNH? So I think those are great examples for Australia and for the government to take on board.
I've taken some notes and I'll definitely send them to the Prime Minister. But anyway, this is all that we have time for today. Julia, thank you very much for taking the time to discuss such an important and engaging topic with me today. You certainly have a lot on your plate, making the world a happier place during those trying times. So I do really appreciate your time and want to send you a big namaste from down under.
Oh, it's such a pleasure, Alexandre. Thank you so much. In Bhutan, we would say Tashi Delek.
You've been listening to Lowy Institute Conversations, a podcast from the Lowy Institute, hosted by Institute experts, with production assistance from Josh Godding. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to joining you for the next episode of Lowy Institute Conversations.